So I want to welcome warmly our guest for today, Scott Beach, who is at the University of Hong Kong, and he's agreed to talk in our short conversations with legal theorists series for our class. For those who are now watching us out there, could you say a few words of introduction about yourself?
Sure. Thank you very much, Julian, for having me in your course to say something. I'm a professor of jurisprudence at the University of Hong Kong, and I've been here for the last 10 years. Prior to that, I was in Scotland, which is my home country, at the University of Glasgow for also about 10 years. And prior to that, I taught in Australia for a number of years at Macquarie University in Sydney. And working right back, I did my PhD and undergraduate law studies at the University of Edinburgh, which is my hometown. So that's it in reverse. So where I am now is obviously hitting the news for all kinds of different reasons and is a fascinating place to be studying jurisprudence at the moment. So that's the kind of timeline, as it were, trajectory of my academic life. I also have another life as well, but we can leave that for another time.
This just brings me to my next question, which is the title of my class. My class is, it's a general class in jurisprudence. It's called Jurisprudence and Critical Approaches to Law. So as a teacher of jurisprudence yourself, how would you understand the field of jurisprudence? How would you characterize your own approach to jurisprudence? And also, would you call it jurisprudence? Would you call it legal theory, legal philosophy, law and critique, something else?
Okay. I know that there are different names associated with this kind of study. So legal theory, legal philosophy, jurisprudence. My own preference is for jurisprudence. That seems to me a nicer word. And also it captures something of the breadth of the subject. So for me, jurisprudence, my inspiration comes in fact from someone who taught jurisprudence at Glasgow University in the 18th century, namely Adam Smith, who of course is better known as an economist, but he was first of all a moral philosopher, and he also lectured in jurisprudence. His lectures in jurisprudence were never published, but two sets of student notes, complete student notes, were discovered, the second set only in the 20th century. And there he's got a remarkable breadth. So he's interested in how law develops, what effects law and legal institutions have on the morals of a society, on the economy of a society. And these are all very broad ways of understanding the impact of law on legal institutions. And in order to do that, he reflects on legal history, but also social history, economic history, the role of the family, let's say. And whilst I don't agree with his readings, he was, of course, and still a man of his time, that sense of curiosity about the wider arena of legal analysis and legal impact seems to me to be crucial. So I would take my range of reference very broadly. So jurisprudence is many of these things, or all of these things, understanding the relation between different elements of social organization and legal organization. It's curiosity in trying to find out mm-hmm. how these things work, how they all work together. That seems to me what mm-hmm. jurisprudence is about. And it puts law and legal institutions center stage, but it also has a much wider cast of players.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps as a follow-up to that question, you're mentioning the breadth of Adam Smith, who has, of course, talked about many aspects of society. Could you think of some modern authors who have influenced your outlook on jurisprudence with such an outlook?
Yeah, I guess contemporary authors. In fact, I think your teachers tend to be very influential. So mm-hmm. I was fortunate to have Neil McCormick as one of my PhD supervisors, and he had an amazing ability to encourage reflection and be tolerant towards very many different views, but also to again see law in that much wider setting. So you're often your first teachers are very important in that respect. As it turns out, for me, jurisprudentially, some of the most influential people who I don't know, who I have and could never meet, are not, in fact, legal academics. Mm-hmm. So Michel Foucault would be one example of that. Alistair MacIntyre, the philosopher, introduces me, but also anyone who reads him, to a sense of the breadth and contingency of history with respect to moral thinking. And so these are the kinds of people that I think I always go back to when I'm thinking about new projects or new ideas. And one of the ways that I think you know people are influencing you is that they, when you go back to their text, you always find something new. Mm-hmm. You always, there's a depth or a richness to their work that is always fresh.
Mm-hmm. This being said, what do you think might be the role of jurisprudence within the law school? In our faculty, we do have a jurisprudence course, which is a mandatory course for second year law students. Do you think jurisprudence has still a role, an important role to play, a valuable role for students, both in their academic lives as students, but also beyond in their professional lives?
It's a good question, and I'm sure it's one question that all law students faced with a compulsory course in jurisprudence ask themselves at some point. What I would say, when you asked me about this, or said you would be asking me this, I was thinking I am spending quite a bit of time this summer going to courts in Hong Kong, where there are trials of protesters last year, serious charges of political, political, what I would think of as political offences. The debate in Hong Kong, in amongst the legal profession, is deeply jurisprudential. When I'm talking to defence lawyers, let's say, yes, they have to know the details of the procedure, but what they're doing and how they're thinking about this and the whole strategy is very much informed by jurisprudential reflection. So we've got problems of the rule of law, central problems of defending the rule of law against a one-party authoritarian state. That is a profoundly jurisprudential question. You have questions of human rights, respect for human rights, respect for procedural mm-hmm. rights, and so on. With respect to sentencing, you have all kinds of questions about whether deterrence is appropriate or whether you can rehabilitate a political offender. Well, what would that mean? Would it mean re-education? So in the courts, on the streets of Hong Kong for this last year and longer, questions of legal philosophy or questions of jurisprudence have been absolutely central mm-hmm. to understanding, to explaining, to thinking your way forward in terms of what the political situation. Now, not everywhere is the same as here, but mm-hmm. scratch the surface and they will be. Questions of justice, questions of injustice, questions of holding power to account. All these are deeply jurisprudential questions. So I think what a jurisprudence course can do is allow students that space within the legal curriculum to reflect on these foundational questions, to be exposed to readings and ideas and thinkers that they might not have time to cover within the public mm-hmm. law course or within the contract law course or whatever it happens to be. So it gives them the space and the depth to think seriously about these issues, these problems, and these will stay with them throughout their professional career, whether that's in law or whether it's in government or whatever, policy or whatever. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's not just special pleading. I'm interested in jurisprudence. Everyone should be. Everyone, in a sense, is. They may not articulate it in the way that we as lawyers teaching in a law faculty do, but as I say, scratch the surface and very quickly you'll find really important jurisprudential mm-hmm. questions about injustice, about structures of discrimination and so on. So these mm-hmm. are a number of reasons I think why it's a great way to allow yourself that space to think about these problems.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to ask you about your international experience that you alluded to in the beginning. So you studied with Neil McCormick in Edinburgh, then you went to Glasgow, but you've also been in Australia, and you also were in Brussels, where we just happened to meet myself as a student. And I wanted to ask you a little bit, about how that international experience has shaped or transformed your jurisprudential outlook. Because right at this moment, you're talking about certain embeddedness in the social context within which you are operating. So the reality in Hong Kong, and you've also mentioned something in Scotland. So I wanted to ask you about that international experience and how it has modeled your view on law.
Yeah, I think one thing that we all experience, even if we're just going on holiday to a different country or a different culture, is it throws your assumptions into relief. It shows you that what you take for absolutely for granted are certain contingent things when you look at them from different perspectives. So one of the effects of working and studying in different countries is that you're constantly exposed, and these questions keep refreshing themselves as you move from country to country. So I think that's a really important thing. I think you see that there are many different ways of doing things. One of the things that I have been exposed to, particularly working in Australia, but also having spent time in South Africa, were the effects of colonialism, effects of racism. And you wouldn't have got that. I didn't really have any sense of that or experience of that if I just stayed in Scotland or in the UK and worked there. Of course, I could have read about it, but I think being there actually and speaking to people, being curious and speaking to people, makes you understand that the world is a complex, amazing, but often very unjust place. And two things strike you about that. One is that each place is slightly different, but the other is that there are commonalities as well. Mm-hmm. You know, we are human, and we get treated in similar ways depending on where we are, or what our gender is, or what our race, the racial composition of a particular society is. So I think when you're traveling, you get exposed to that kind of thing viscerally. You can't help but take it in. So I think these, to me, are kind of defining of or constitutive of the way that I am. And therefore, it has an impact. I can't turn that side of my brain off when it comes to writing about jurisprudential things. So there's certainly space for writing purely or abstract conceptual stuff, because that's part of trying to work things out. But you can't divorce that from the realities and the contingencies of different places, different social systems, different power structures as well.
Yeah, certainly in your work, the topic of transitional justice has been an important topic. And you have been writing critically about many different aspects of law, on labor and work relations. You've been writing critically also on political economy, on the underlying political liberalism and the culture of legalism, on legal reasoning as well. I wanted to ask a little bit if there is something that unites these threads together, and in fact, if there is a common target of the critique.
It's a good question. It's quite a tough question, because I do what interests me. That's one of the luxuries of this job, if you like. But what interests me is, again, this term that I've used, that what I'm curious, I want to find out more about how something works. But the other thing that has inspired a lot of my work is I get really annoyed by things. You know, why is this happening? Why are young kids right now in Hong Kong getting locked up because they believe in equality? What's going on? You know, I want to get to some understanding of this. And then as part of our job, you want to write it down and share it with people. But I think that's inspired a lot of my work in terms of being critical. And I think being critical here doesn't mean just criticizing things. As I'm sure that the students taking your course will find out, being critical means being reflective, finding out all the information, finding out different ways of looking at the same problem or the same way of looking at different problems. That in that sense, your method, I see as kind of like methods are like spectacle, like glasses. You put them on and you can see different things. So the more you learn about different ways of seeing problems, the more insight you can get, but also the more you will see, in fact. And So in that sense, I think that's what, so there's a methodological openness that I think has is a constant throughout my work. So I'm not just interested in, let's say, a particular one methodology, let's say analytical jurisprudence that analyze something deeply in conceptual terms. No, I need to know more. I need to know how the society is working. So methodological openness, I think, is the other, as well as the substantive side of things, has been part of the constancy.
And perhaps that sense of injustice that that animates your work, I see as a quite a common thread, as you describe, that initial anger or that willingness to change things or to stir some trouble, I guess it's also part of what animates you to write, isn't it?
Definitely, definitely. There's a sense of justice that we all have, you know, whether it's, you know, our brother or sister treating us unfairly or our parents. We have that early on. And I think as lawyers and as thinkers, sometimes that can get blunted, but sometimes it's you're exposed to it in a way that you can't not be affected by it. And I think, you know, there's a tremendous amount of really good legal professional work that is inspired by the desire to change things, having seen certain injustices taking place or continuing to take place. So I think it is important in that sense as well for legal practitioners to be exposed to what they wouldn't necessarily see if they were focusing just on one particular area.
I also wanted to ask you about the role of law in particular in your work, because in your book, Law and Irresponsibility, there is quite a whole, say, critique of law, and perhaps it's the most, I don't want to call it pessimistic, but the one where law is taken to task, as you define, for its role in the production and legitimation of human suffering. And I wonder what was behind this idea, what motivated you to raise that critical point in the particular historical time in which you were writing. If you could elaborate a little bit of what you meant for law and irresponsibility.
Okay, I think what had inspired it was the kinds of things we've just been talking about, traveling, spending time. Australia, particularly thinking about the treatment of Aboriginal peoples in Australia, but not just in Australia, in many countries as well. Also having spent time in South Africa, attending hearings at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission when I was on sabbatical there for 6 months, going to hearings every day and getting a sense of how was this possible? How was it possible to have a legal regime that treated people so awfully? And the question of legitimacy and legality kind of come together or thrown into question there. So what struck me and the kind of central part of the book was that we think of law, and law is, in fact, a way of holding people to account. We are held responsible for our actions, whether that's in private law, contract, making a contract with someone, or whether it's in criminal law, if someone assaults us, then they should be held responsible. So law is a way of organizing responsibility in that sense. But what struck me most was this: was the bigger the harm, the bigger the injustice, the less responsibility there seemed to be. So literally getting away with murder, the more people were murdered, the more people were damaged, the bigger the land stealing was, like stealing a continent in Australia, you know, the bigger it was, the more you got away with it if you used legal techniques. So here was this strange juxtaposition. On the one hand, law does hold people responsible for their actions. On the other hand, when it comes to these massive harms, it seems that law not only doesn't hold people to account, but is somehow implicated in getting them off the hook. Mm-hmm. So law is, in that sense, also involved in organizing irresponsibility, in allowing people, or rather the same conceptual and institutional tools that make responsibility appear can also make it disappear. So that was the central kind of insight or hunch that I followed through. Mm-hmm. And I looked at big picture things like colonialism. And it ends on a very pessimistic note, which is the nuclear weapons. They haven't gone away. But so the idea that you've got enough nuclear capacity to blow up the planet 100 times over, and it's legal. Wow, this is amazing. How can this happen? So there's an analysis of international law, analysis of the ICG advisory opinion, and so on. So I'd like to think it's not completely depressing, but it's realistic that we must consider that law can do good things, but it can also do or be involved in producing really bad things. And so that's the kind of elements behind the book.
Mm-hmm. And I have perhaps one last question, which is about your most recent work, about your most recent book, which is forthcoming. And you've been quite gracious to share it with my students. They've had the chance to read a chapter, some excerpts. And I see there perhaps a turn towards a more reconceptualizing work, towards obligations and the world of obligations rather than rights. And I would like to ask you about how is that you see that work reorienting the way we talk about political community, the way we talk about the economy, the environment, even interpersonal relationships. So what does the language of obligations allow you to accomplish, legally speaking or jurisprudentially speaking?
Okay, but two things. One is, again, is a kind of sort of descriptive point. When you look at the work that law does, rights are really important. So we do focus a lot, and lawyers in particular focus a lot on rights. But when you look more closely or dig down a bit, you find that there are many more obligations or legal obligations than there are rights. So that one person's right, this is a point that Jeremy Waldron, the philosopher, legal philosopher at NYU makes, he says there are waves of duties. So the right not to be tortured, for example, that produces obligations in everyone. It produces obligations also, say, for the police or for the military. And then it produces further obligations. Well, you've got to train people what counts as torture and what doesn't count as torture. Then you've got to train people as to their obligations, how to respond if someone's accused of torturing someone else. So what you see, you have one right and you have these waves of obligation. So descriptively, it seemed to me that rhetoric of rights has overshadowed the reality of the work that obligations do. Mm-hmm. And there's, of course, another dimension to this. It might be I don't know if it's an excerpt that I sent you, but is that historically, rights were only vented about 500 or 600 years ago. Yeah? So most of human history, there were no such things as rights, but there were always things like obligations. Right? So when you look at comparatively different societies, either historically or even today, you see different ways of thinking about the organization of communities. And a focus on rights is a determinedly modern and essentially European one. So part of the project of the book was to re-describe the way in which the world operates in that respect. On the more positive side, or this reconceptualization, it was to say, well, what does it look like when you start from the perspective of the obligation rather than the right? Might it give you a different way of thinking about important contemporary problems? Mm-hmm. So the last chapter is, in a sense, more optimistic. It looks at community and solidarity and so on. And it picks up one example, just briefly at the end, which is the environment, ecological damage that human beings are inflicting on the planet. If we start from a rights perspective, it seems to me that we, with individual rights, property rights in particular, but also sovereignty rights of individual nations, mm-hmm. we are going to keep going on this disastrous track. So maybe one way to rethink, or the starting place to rethink our awareness of ecology is to think of it from the point of view of obligations. And this is, in fact, a very old way. Aboriginal communities, I think, in Australia, but in other countries too, have seen themselves as duty-bound to the earth rather than rights demanders of the earth. So I think this, our mentality as lawyers gets stuck in this rights-based analysis, whereas I think if we invert it or reimagine it, reconceptualize our relations, then obligations give us some leverage there that we might otherwise miss out on. Mm-hmm. But like responsibility, law is kind of double-edged because we've got loads of obligations that are pretty tough, you know, that we don't want. As well, and they fall unevenly. Mm-hmm. Obligations tend to fall unevenly in terms of gender or in terms of race, so we need to be open to that too. But on the other hand, maybe in certain aspects of community or solidarity, obligations do give us a positive possibility that we miss out just by thinking it right.
All right. This has been a great conversation. I want to, again, thank you, Scott, for agreeing to talk to us, to the class. And I hope to catch up soon in person.
Yes, likewise. Well, I wish you well with the course.
Thank you.